Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Occupy Wall Street spreading across the United States, and with a call tomorrow to occupy the London Stock Exchange, are we about to see Britain join in? We look also at how it's been the left in Europe that's led the push for deregulation and the privatisation of banking. And organised crime gangs in government, the City of London and the Metropolitan Police. David Southwell has a special report. Lots of international stuff happening this week. The underpants bomber, his trial opens. Alexander Litvinenko's inquest. The Russian spy supposedly bumped off in London with polonium. Also, a new opposition movement emerges in Syria. And we have more bombs in Egypt. Was there just a military coup in Egypt back in January? Because there are questions over the future Egyptian elections. And finally, driving us crazy as our roads fill with potholes, is our driving getting worse? How much is the rise of the HGV and the car are actual market forces, and how much is it the result of lobbying by the roads lobby and the all sorts of the roads lobby mainly, but all sorts of oil industry influences as well. But first, anyway, as I mentioned in the first half, all three Conservative MPs in the Bristol area have been cancelling their appearances on this show again and again. Charlotte Leslie MP has cancelled twice. She was due to come on last week. And Chris Skidmore was due on this week. He's cancelled three times. And also Jack Lopresti has also cancelled three times in the last few months. So what about this, Martin? I suppose nobody wants to force them to come on and tell the public what they think. It's really up to them, isn't it?
It is up to them. I mean, you know, they may have legitimate reasons for not being able to come on. I don't know. I've no idea. But, I mean, the fact is, if you don't come on, then you don't get your view heard. And they're silly to take that attitude, if that is the attitude.
Well, I've found increasingly that I'm sort of taking a very strong sort of conservative line. As I'm trying, what I'm trying to do is put the opposite point of view so that we tease out the arguments. But, I mean, are the MPs actually obliged to engage with the population in between an election?
Well, they are, but they're not obliged to do individual particular appearances. It's up to them. I mean, I spoke to Charlotte not long ago, and I don't think she was actually not coming on because she didn't want to come on. It's last time I understand she had a throat was sore and she couldn't speak properly. I don't know. I mean, we'll have to see. But I mean, ultimately, it's their lookout. If they don't come on and communicate with people, then people won't know what they think, will they?
Well, also, Lib Dem councillor for Bishopstone, Bev Knott, and one Labour MP, that's the MP for Bristol South, Dawn Primorolo, have also refused to come on. So what does this tell us about our politicians when they say, well, we don't really want to go on Martin and Tony's programme?
Well, I mean, that may be what's going on. It may be that they just can't be bothered and they don't think it's a priority, Tony. I mean, at the end of the day, it's up to them. We have invited them. Like, we've invited the Avon and Somerset Police to come on here to discuss policing matters, and they've always refused, and that's up to them. But then in that case, their case won't be heard, and those who are making allegations against them will make their allegations without being questioned or opposed.
Well,
that's up to them.
What bothers me is it's a bit of a gap in our coverage. And,
well, exactly, and I think we don't want to discourage. I mean, we did have Mark Westbrook, is it? The Conservative councillor. Mark Weston came on as a Conservative councillor some weeks
many
ago.
Many of the councillors have been on, but the MPs seem they don't want to.
And we've had Charlotte Leslie on here before. I mean, let's hope that we can get back to playing cricket. I like cricket. I hope they do too. Jacob Rees-Mogg, did we not?
I wonder though, yes, that's true. I wonder though if maybe it's partly due to the whole financial situation. I do wonder though, you know, when an MP gets elected, it's a long term between actual elections. Surely they're really only interested in engaging with the public when they're up for election.
Well, that may well be true, and they may, you know, they just don't think it's a priority.
There's also the fact, of course, that Dawn's in a very safe seat in South Bristol, so why should she come?
Exactly. It's probably more than likely, Tony, that they don't think we're important enough to bother with, but that's up to them, isn't
it? OK, well, there's that. There is that.
I'm afraid.
Thanks for pointing it out. I've gone all red now, anyway. I've also been inviting Bristol's NHS bosses. That's University Bristol Hospital's chairman, John Savage, and North Bristol NHS Trust chief executive, Ruth Brunton, and they've also either cancelled or simply refused, both of them three times each. The other regular refusenik, Martin just mentioned, is Avon and Somerset's Chief Constable Colin Port. Again, is it these people's job description to represent the massive amounts of public money that they spend and actually explain their position on some of the important issues of the day and how they're spending that money?
Well, it may be that they are either hostile or frightened. I would hope not. Jacob Rees-Mogg, for example, enjoyed his time when he was on.
I'm talking about the officials, public officials now, like the chief constable.
The chief constable may not be available, but surely somebody is. They've got a PR department that employs scores of people. Surely at least one of them could come on.
Of the things that bothers me is that these public relations departments often decide, you know, they make a decision based on what's in it for us, as if they were a commercial business. But actually, of course, the National Health Service and the police are not commercial businesses.
No, they're actually obliged to explain themselves. I think probably some people find a kind of free-form discussion like this a bit intimidating. They like to stick to the script. They don't want to be asked too many awkward questions. I mean, that is the conclusion that the listeners should draw if people can persistently refuse to come on here.
One of the things that I constantly get, actually, particularly from the health service public relations people, is, well, we want a list of questions beforehand. The trouble is, of course, how can you really do that? You know, you're having a real discussion. You can't say what's going to come up in that discussion beforehand. It just isn't fair.
No, and I think some people are more confident in that kind of free-form environment and some people are less confident, it's fair to be said. And I think that many of the people we have had on here from all the parties have been very happy to participate, and we'd like to encourage them all to come on. You will get a fair go from us, is the message that we intend to give. You won't get an easy ride, but you'll get a fair one.
Bristol. Community FM 93.2.
Now on to a discussion about the Occupy Wall Street, what's been going on over there in the United States for the last couple of weeks. We've had thousands camping out on the streets of New York and many other cities across the United States. Why is this now, Martin?
Because the banks are collapsing and everybody realises that the economy is about to fall apart and suddenly there's a bit of a panic. People realise that things are not right, and at a certain point it all boils over.
Well, we've had Roseanne Barr from the famous Roseanne series speaking to the public down there in New York. She's says that she will be running for president, and she's also calling for the guillotine for some of these senior bankers such as Jamie Dimon.
Well, I mean, that's just political rhetoric, isn't it? We need to arrest people who've been carrying out fraudulent activities, corrupt activities related to financial fraud and corruption. And you don't use a guillotine, you use modern methods. You give them a fair trial and then you send them to prison.
We've seen one senior financial, I think he was a hedge fund guy, go down just literally yesterday into jail for insider trading. Now, I wonder, I mean, we've talked about fraud quite a lot on this show and accounting fraud and this kind of thing. But what about insider dealing? Because surely that may be another reason that these people have been breaking
the law. Well, there's a very interesting statistic that I read not long ago that members of the US Congress have share portfolios. They're all wealthy people. Virtually every member of the US Congress is a millionaire, at least, and they have share portfolios. And their share portfolios mysteriously do about 10% better than the market. Now, why would that be? I would suggest it's because they have insider knowledge about upcoming government legislation, upcoming government activities, for example declaring war, things that are going to happen, and that's why their share portfolios outperform the market by 10%.
Well, Michael Moore, the filmmaker, has been down there giving little speeches and things, chatting to all the people who are camping out in New York, as well as I mentioned, Roseanne Barr. But somebody else who's been down is a former top finance guy called Joe Stiglitz. Can you just tell us who
is? Joe Stiglitz is not really a hedge fund shark. He used to head up the World Bank in the Clinton era, before Clinton was bought out by the forces of darkness, if you like. And I saw, and he, you know, he's basically a well-meaning academic economist, and he's gone down to show his support for people's right to protest against Wall Street's misbehaviour. That's all.
Now it's not all, because we're going to hear now from Joe Stiglitz when he was interviewed by a US group called We Are Change.
What role do you think the private Federal Reserve banking system had an effect in this crisis?
Oh, there's no doubt that their role as a regulator, they failed in that role to stop the crisis. And they said things like, bubbles don't exist, you can't tell whether a bubble is there, we don't have the instruments. Every one of those propositions was wrong. So it was mainly in their role, the deficiencies in their role of oversight of the financial system, that they failed. If this were the first time that the financial sector has, you might say, misbehaved, you might say, who could have seen it? But this has happened over and over again, and so in that sense, their failure to see what was going on was almost unforgivable.
We know Geithner said a couple weeks ago, he didn't know he was being recorded, but he said, Obama doesn't make the decisions, I do. What do you think about institutions like the Bilderberg Group, which the Federal Reserve is in, Timothy Geithner is in, and all these secret elites are in, who in 2006 said they were going to plan to destroy the U.S. economy in order to consolidate weight? Do you have an opinion on the Bilderberg
Group? I don't know about that group, so I have nothing I can comment.
Now, what do you think about what Joe had to say there? Because he's almost like a gamekeeper turned poacher, is that right?
He's basically a high-powered academic economist, and basically the World Bank is a public sector institution, and so he's not actually one of the bad guys at the heart of all of this. I think what he's saying there is that Fed has failed through a failure of imagination, a failure of ideas. What the questioner is trying to get him to accept is that there's something more going on here, and that there's, you know, basically criminal activity. Now, the fact that Geithner said it's not Obama that runs things, I do, I think that's very revealing, because Geithner used to work for Goldman Sachs, who's one of their top people, and I think that's very revealing about the real balance of power. But I don't think you can start bringing in the Bilderberg Group and everything else in one go. And Stiglitz, can you see, he just steps around that. He says, I don't know anything about that group. He is basically a mainstream, decent bloke, and he's not willing to contemplate probably what is going on. The problem of presentation for the We Are Change person who's interviewing him is you can't pack a question with all of that freight and expect a serious answer in one sentence. It's just not going to be there.
But surely there is, possibly anyway, big financial motives in insider trading.
Of course.
And ultimately, who's going to win this power struggle? I mean, this is something I ask again and again, between the governments, our elected representatives, and these private interests really running these investment banks.
Well, there's no contest at this stage. The elected representatives are funded by the private interests, which are the problem, and that is the problem. And the real problem in the US now is you've got raving mad right-wing Republicans who want to slash everything in sight, which will actually wreck the world economy. They nearly wrecked the world economy recently by refusing to agree to this deal about budgets. And then we've got Obama, who basically is in the pocket of Wall Street. So if you are a progressively inclined voter in the US, you haven't actually got anybody to vote for. And that is really depressing. We may get a third party breakthrough, possibly by Ron Paul, especially if he brings Kucinich, who's a left-wing Democrat, onto his ticket. That would be a very interesting contest. But the problem is, what Obama is doing in America is what Blair used to do here, is it's me or nothing. You just get these crazies who are going to slash everything in sight. Now, Obama has let us down badly. He's let down his own constituency completely. So people are very disillusioned, and there doesn't seem to be anywhere else to go. Because first past the post doesn't give you anywhere else to go. If they had a PR system, it would all be much more flexible.
Yeah, but Martin, why do you say, why is it that Obama has let people down? Why do you think?
Because he's basically, don't forget, all politicians have got two constituencies. One is the voters, the other is the people who provide the money to do what they do. And even if they don't intend to personally profit, they still need resources, and therefore they have to get resources. Where do they get them from? They get them from people with money, and at the end of the day, those people have got an agenda, and that's the problem. And in the US, the Supreme Court, which has been packed by the right for 20 years now, is virtually 100% in their control, recently passed legislation that anybody can contribute to any political campaign anonymously. So basically, any amount of money can be chucked at a political campaign, and nobody's to know who's paying for it. That is a recipe for disaster, and disaster will follow.
Now, we just heard from Joe Stiglitz, an honourable example of someone who's worked in the World Bank, as you said. Are there others like Joe that have sort of come out of the city, maybe
well, no,
even
yeah, but
from
retirement? You've got to remember that the academic economists from the universities are not the city, and they've been warning about all of this nonsense for years and years and years and years and years, but they get ignored. And, of course, what the financial people do is they create their own academic sounding boards. They fund chairs in economics. The Swedish Central Bank is controlled by right-wing people, and they always give it to the same people. And they've basically, over the years, managed to push what is actually not really main hardcore economic analysis. It's basically self-interested puff, and self-interested puff has become the mainstream of the profession. There are good people out there. There's Michael Hudson, there's James Galbraith, who's the son of John Kenneth Galbraith, who used to advise Roosevelt. You've got lots of good people out there. There's Wynne Godley, who's died recently. He's a British guy. But they are ignored because there's a cacophony of noise coming from the other side of the aisle. And most of this is just self-interested, self-referential. I was reading a book, reading an article about an IMF internal document where they basically admitted that the problem why they didn't see the crisis coming was groupthink. They were all unwilling to look at other ways of looking at it, and therefore they didn't see it coming. Now, that you've got two lots of people on the dark side. One is the people who know exactly what they're doing and don't care because they're criminals, and the other side are naive. But naive, basically, and they don't understand how the world works. They think that maths is A-level economics. They think that economics is A-level maths writ large, and it's not. Economics is political economy. It's all related to social relations. There's always a political aspect to economic decisions, and mainstream economics doesn't understand that. They think they're scientists. They're nothing like scientists. Physicists look at their formulas and go, this is rubbish. What you're doing basically is inventing a mathematical puzzle. What you've actually got to do is look at the real world, take some measurements, and then write a theory. It's called science. What they do is that most of these derivative contracts are based upon mathematical extrapolation. They've got no basis in reality at all. And a lot of the theories which underpin the crisis are basically, they were discredited 100 years ago, not even 50 years ago, but they've come back in a fantastically mathematicalized form, and therefore, because it's very, very clever maths, they think it must be right, but it isn't, it's wrong. And the maths can be as clever as you like, but like they used to say about computers, it's rubbish in, rubbish out, isn't it?
Now, you mentioned Michael Hudson there. Russia Today featured him on its analysis.
From Kansas University.
Analysis of the euro crisis a couple of weeks ago, and saying that the euro crisis is what seems like an unfathomable problem. Or is it just being made to seem that way? Let's have a listen to Michael now, plus one or two other contributors as well.
Fortunately, the Social Democrats, whether it's in Germany or in any other European Union country, operate under Thatcher's maxim that there is no alternative. They're not acting as Social Democrats, and they're not imagining any different policy. Moreover, when the public actually does begin to engage these issues, they're charged with acting in populist ways. I mean, they're just absolutely dismissed. The level of arrogance by policymakers on this particular issue is extreme. And it's not even permitting any kind of meaningful debate to take place. The discourse is at a very low level.
What do you think about that?
This is exactly the problem. Imagine 100 years ago, nobody could imagine that the Social Democratic and the Labour parties are now to the right of the Conservatives. Yeah. The left wing is now the right wing. It's the left wing parties that have led the fight for privatization and to turn over power to the banks. And it's as if they've somehow been taken over by the banking sectors and they're socialist in name only. We used to call them fascists right. In America.
If I can just interject with one more follow-up point. What it's resulted in, both in the United States and in much of Europe, is to confuse the electorate massively. So, for instance, the United States, President Barack Obama, who I actually voted for and gave money to, has acted in a very center-right, even right-wing fashion when it comes to finance. What's happened with the electorate is, because he's often charged with being a leftist by Murdoch Media, they assume that he's very left, so now they need to go very far right. And that's why I think you see this oscillation back and forth within European Union countries between social democratic governments and conservative governments. The electorate is just terribly confused, and they just don't see an alternative.
That was a discussion a couple of weeks ago on the satellite channel Russia Today. Now, Martin, what about this accusation there? And you're a Labour Party member, that actually the left has to a large extent been responsible for this across Europe in actually helping privatisations and also aiding bank deregulation. The left has been doing this.
I quite agree. And it also happened in the US. It was the Clinton administration that abolished the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated retail banking from casino banking. The fact of the matter is that many people on the left thought that capitalism had won, and that what they concluded was that because capitalism had won, and they didn't really, you know, understanding how capitalism works and why it's likely to fail and what the alternatives would be, used to be grist to the mill. We used to argue about it endlessly in my youth. But what's happened now, of course, is until recently, was the idea that capitalism had won. So what we're really talking about is who can manage capitalism best. And the left then presented itself as more competent managers of capitalism than the Conservatives. Sometimes they were, sometimes they weren't. But discussion of alternatives was just basically forgotten about. So when they were all completely stunned when the banking system just went and collapsed itself, because that wasn't supposed to happen. You remember Gordon Brown speaking at the Mansion House in the City of London just before Lehman Brothers collapsed, congratulating the City of London on what a great job it was doing and how fantastic it all was. And then 2 weeks later, the whole thing went down the tubes. And Gordon Brown was as stunned as anybody else. And you know why? Because they switched off the bit of their minds where they think about what capitalism is really about years ago. And so when capitalism just manages to go feral, they're completely at a loss of what to say. And what Michael Hudson's saying about people being confused, they are confused. They voted for Obama for him to get a grip on the financial sector. Not only did he not get a grip on the financial sector, he did exactly what they wanted him to do. And don't forget that the financial sector people are smart. What they do is they back both horses in the race. Don't forget they're hedge funders. So what they do is they fund the Conservatives to create a very, very far right, which then frightens people, and then they fund the left, so-called, to do exactly what they want. So that what they're looking for, probably, is for the Republicans in the US, for example, to choose somebody who's unelectable, so that Obama will be re-elected, because people haven't got any choice. It's Obama or a nutcase, so they've got to vote for Obama, and then Obama's in their pocket, so they get what they want. And that's the problem. Ultimately, it's all about money, and very few people have resolved this on the left. The Labour Party used to deal with this by getting funding from the trade unions. The trade unions are actually not very wealthy, and the Conservative Party is trying to cut that off by, basically by manipulating the rules about party donations. Ultimately, all political movements have to resolve the problem of money, because that's what it's all about. And at the end of the day, each successive election in Britain or in the US gets more and more expensive, which gives the wealthy classes a bigger and bigger stranglehold on the process. And they are ultimately quite like a Punch and Judy show, where you've got extreme right-wingers who are calling for no taxes at all for the wealthy people. So if Obama calls for some taxes for them, he's acceptable. And they can live with that, because basically they are never challenged. Their way of doing things, the private banks are sacrosanct, we must rescue them. They are acting as if the private banking system was the important thing and the economy at large was a completely secondary matter, and that we must rescue the private banks, come what may, whatever may happen. And that, of course, is what's got us into the mess. But it's a pointless victory, because they're sawing off the branch they're sitting on. And when it all collapses, a different kind of politics will emerge, which won't be based on money. It's going to be based on pure anger.
Now, one of the problems, of course, in all this is that you have sort of the banking sector, the City of London in this country, and it seems that there's been a penetration of at least some of that by organised crime.
They need bank accounts like everybody else, don't they?
And the other thing is, with the police, because, I mean, the only way that criminals can operate within the City of London is if the fraud squad, the Metropolitan Police particularly, but the policing side of things is kind of paralysed.
Well, that's right, and it's not difficult to make it happen. A lot of the frauds they're involved in are sophisticated things. These guys are clever. They're clever at running scams, and they're able to get round people who are chasing after them, especially if they're not properly funded. I mean, this morning, the property company that owns Zuccotti Park, which used to be Liberty Park, which is where the Wall Street protesters are camped out, said they want these people kicked off. And I don't know what happened about that, but I mean, basically, they are able to shut down people they don't like, and they do. They take steps to rubbish them. They use their paid media like Fox News to make them look stupid if they can. And if that doesn't work, then we just use the fact that we own the flipping park and you've got to go.
Well, the news is, just looking on the web, that the clean-up, or, as they call it, of Zuccotti Park...
Oh, yes, the clean-up of Zuccotti Park.
...has been cancelled. So they're still there. Anyway, now let's have a listen to the penetration by into the City of London, particularly of one particularly nasty criminal, a guy called Charlie Richardson. And he was one of the Richardson brothers who were compared quite often to the Cray twins.
Yeah, they were South London, weren't they? And the Cray twins are East.
That's right. And here's a special report, an extract, in fact, from David Southwell's book, The History of Organised Crime, read by Malcolm Grieve. It gives us a real idea of the penetration of some of our top levels of policing, government and the city by organised criminals.
The History of Organised Crime by David Southwell. The naturally memorable nature of identical twins being crime lords and the publicity surrounding them may have made Ronnie and Reggie Cray the most iconic English gangsters of the 20th century. But two other brothers will go down in history as having headed London's most feared and respected organised crime family in the 1960s. Charlie and Eddie Richardson ran what even Ronnie Cray later called a mightily powerful and feared organisation. The Crays might have held the East End of London in their grip and been a major power in West End clubland, but the Richardson gang ruled the underworld roost in South London. According to former Billy Hill gang member Frankie Fraser, who had eventually joined the Richardsons, comparing the Crays and the Richardsons were miles in front in everything, especially brain power. I was brought up on family tales of the Richardsons. The comic cliché of them being good to their mother was even given credence by my own mother, having attended both family picnics and weddings with them. The widespread mythology that the Crays made the streets of East London safe from petty crime is much less pronounced around the Richardsons. However, in reality, it seems to hold much more truth, as I've met more than one South London villain who received a smack from Charlie Richardson and was told to piss off up the West End and steal from some rich bastards. Charlie was born in 1934 and his brother Eddie in 1936. The sons of a former prize fighter, they grew up in Camberwell, South London. Charlie's early career in petty crime was interrupted by his call-up for national service, during which he received a court-martial for his attitude and insubordination, and served time in Shepton Mallet Military Prison alongside the Crays. He founded a legitimate and profitable scrap business that had a chain of 5 yards across South London and a string of drinking clubs. He fled to Canada in 1959 when he was charged with receiving stolen goods, but returned in 1961, having set up, run, and then sold a legitimate company during his time away, and managed to avoid the charge against him. With his brother Eddie on board, Charlie set about expanding his business interests, both legitimate and illegal. By 1966, the brothers and the gang they had built up around them was running one of the most successful and sophisticated criminal networks that England has ever seen. They had interests in everything from airport ticket machine fraud to fruit machine rackets, long firm swindles with added arson, to clubland extortion and diamond smuggling. Charlie always hated the word gang, seeing his organisation only as a group of business associates, saying, "Gangs are what kids have, or big kids in American films." They ruled through fear of the violent retribution that would be dealt out to anyone who crossed them, and yet it was this retribution that brought about their downfall. In 1966, a squad of 100 Scotland Yard detectives seized the Richardson brothers and 11 of their associates. They were charged with torture and other violent crimes against an assortment of criminals who had tried to cheat them. The police may have overstated tales of the Richardson system of kangaroo courts and torture, but there was certainly sufficient evidence of electrodes being attached to certain delicate body parts and other bits being removed without anaesthetic for Charlie to receive the longest sentence for grievous bodily harm, 25 years, ever handed out by a British court. His brother got set down for 10 years. Eddie Richardson was released in 1976. However, in 1990, he received another 25 years for smuggling cocaine. On his release from prison in 1984, Charlie Richardson went to work in the City of London, carving out a successful career in the financial markets. His universally well-regarded brain helped him to reap legitimate rewards on the stock exchange. Interestingly, Charlie has commented that the city is far more dishonest than anything I did before, and perhaps jokingly that the biggest organised crime in Britain was performed by the government, stealing something the British people already owned and selling it back to them. The privatisation of nationalised industries under Margaret Thatcher. Of the many insights Charlie Richardson has made since becoming a widely respected and purely legitimate businessman, the most controversial is possibly his suggestion that the most lucrative, powerful and extensive protection racket ever to exist was administered by London's Metropolitan Police. What could sound like a meaningless jibe at the honesty of Scotland Yard's officers is unfortunately supported by a sordid history of fact. It shows not only police extortion of criminals, but also active collusion between many in the Metropolitan Police and the organised criminal underworld, and goes back more than 50 years. Research has proved that some Met officers are drawing two salaries, one official one and one from Billy Hill, while others were known to have colluded in major heists, such as Hill's infamous East Castle Street job in 1952. Richardson's claim that he made regular payments to the police, and that it was a sort of tax on crime, may have seemed fanciful at the time of his arrest in 1966, but it later became clear he was speaking from a position of knowledge. In 1969, the Times newspaper revealed that there was a firm within a firm, corrupt police officers within the Metropolitan Police, who could arrange for charges to be dropped in exchange for large cash sums. Following this eye-opener, three officers were charged, but bigger scandals were yet to come. In 1972, the Sunday People newspaper printed pictures of the head of the flying squad, Commander Ken Drury, holidaying with noted Soho villain and pornographer Jimmy Humphreys. When Humphreys was charged with a severe slashing in 1973, he revealed that the Dirty Squad, the nickname for the obscene publication squad responsible for tackling illegal pornography, were really dirty cops. His evidence showed Commander Wally Virgo and Detective Chief Superintendent Bill Moody received thousands of pounds to turn a blind eye to organised crime in Soho. Both men were convicted, while a host of junior officers also received prison sentences. In the wake of the judge's statement that elements of the police had been operating a vast protection racket, the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, Sir Robert Mark, ironically remarked, "A good police force is one that catches more criminals than it employs." In 1978, he instigated Operation Countryman, costing £4 million and involving a task force of more than 200 officers working for 4 years. Despite massive obstruction, Operation Countryman saw the mainly rural Dorset police force investigate Scotland Yard for corruption. Their report has never been made public, but it is known that they recommended that nearly 300 officers should face criminal charges for corruption and colluding with organised criminals. However, only 4 officers were eventually prosecuted. In 1994, Metropolitan Police Commissioner Sir Paul Condon told Parliament that his force contained 250 bent officers. A decade on, only a handful of these have been successfully charged.
And that was Malcolm Grieve reading that particular chapter from The History of Organised Crime by David Southwell on the Richardson Brothers. Now, Martin, 250 bent cops in Scotland Yard, a firm within a firm.
Well, I mean, that's history, obviously. I mean, things have moved on now, and organised crime is much better organised than it used to be.
Well, Charlie...
It's probably, doing far more... it's doing more than it was doing then, basically.
Well, certainly Charlie Richardson has moved on from being a South London gangster into a nice job at the city as soon as he stepped out of prison.
Yeah, well, there's an awful lot of overlap in skill set, I think. Basically, don't forget that the international drugs trade has really taken off since that era, and that gives massive, massive potential for corruption, fraud on every
level.
Why
is that? Why?
Why? Because the amount of money involved is enormous, and the fact of the matter is that basically drug dealers have got enormous amounts of spare cash, and cops are not always particularly well paid, and there's always been an issue of the possibility of police being corrupted by the people that they police. They deal with criminals all the time. The temptation is there. They can get away with it, and they often do.
Well, it does create these massive slush funds, the drug industry. We've been hearing about these Mexican cartels recently. Yeah. Do you think that any of that money manages to find its way into the hands of politicians?
Of course it does. Of course it does, all over the world. Especially in Latin America, where people are extremely aware of it. I mean, this Iranian plot, supposedly, to assassinate the Israeli and the Saudi Arabian ambassador, I mean, it's a fraudulent plot, let's put it straight, let's be quite clear about that. But the way in which it worked was that this deadbeat, drunk used car salesman went to Mexico to find a Mexican drug cartel person to assassinate the Saudi ambassador, and he ran into a DEA agent from the US.
Drug enforcement agency.
Now, in actual fact, this plot is actually fully set up. I mean, there's something called... It's making news in the US, where the Bureau of Alcohol and Firearms, that organisation, basically sold the US, the Mexican drug cartels hundreds of high quality machine guns, and then didn't bother to track what they were doing. Now that's because the intelligence services, particularly the CIA, but includes the British intelligence service, have been involved in drug dealing for years, because it's a means of funding their activities without being accountable. And so the right-wing paramilitaries in Colombia, who kill a lot of social activists, the Auto Unidas Defensas de Colombia, and now the Black Eagles, they are drug dealers, and they are given the wink by the Colombian government and by the US, because they're quite happy with what they're doing. They can't give them money directly, so they just facilitate their drug trading as a means of keeping them in business. And that's been going on for years.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
OK, Martin, now we're going to have a quick roundup of some of the international stories. One of the biggies this week is Litvinenko and the fact that his inquest has started in London. What are your thoughts about, what do you know about actually that one? One of the things that I can tell you struck me as very strange is the way that this is a radioactive polonium that was used to poison him, which leaves this kind of trail wherever it goes. So it's almost as if it's bound to lead back to somewhere. Why would anybody that wanted to poison him use something that left this kind of nuclear trail behind it?
Well, I think we need to bring the listeners up to speed here. This is the guy who died a few years ago. You explained this. He was poisoned with polonium. Nobody disputes that.
He was a Russian. He was an author.
Yes.
He was in London.
Yes, I mean, and his book, Blowing Up Russia, he used to work as an FSB agent. He was an FSB agent. And he wrote it with Yuri Feltinsky. And anybody can buy a copy. There's extracts available on the internet. Basically, he's saying that the bombings in Moscow in 1999 and Ryazan, which killed hundreds of ordinary working class people in big housing projects, was actually carried out by the Russian FSB, not by the Chechens.
Well, it's obvious then, isn't it? Sorry, someone like Putin, who was in power at the time, he's got a very strong motive.
Putin wasn't in power, but it helped him to come to power. He won the election in the November after the September bombs.
But, I mean, there's an obvious motive there for Putin not to want this guy going around writing books about his dirty work.
Let me suggest, as you just suggested, if Putin wanted him killed, it was something that didn't lead back to his people. The other suggestion is that Berezovsky, who was Putin's Putin was Berezovsky's right-hand man in 1999 when
this
the bombs
This is Boris Berezovsky.
Boris Berezovsky
London,
was a sort of Rupert Murdoch figure in Russia. And what was the political context of this? They were about to have a presidential election in November 1999, and Zyuganov and the Communist Party were looking as if they were going to win. Now, that wouldn't have been unusual. In virtually every East European country, the second election was won by the former communists, who had reformed their act and basically were coming back to the people saying, look, we're sorry about all the things that we did in the past, but you need us because basically this free market stuff is killing you. And it was a very popular, there was no reason why Zyuganov shouldn't have won. Alexander Kwasniewski had won in Poland. This was the kind of thing that was going to happen. So they planted the bombs. Berezovsky and Putin were the conspirators, and then Putin came to power and Berezovsky and Putin fell out because Putin was not going to be a puppet for Berezovsky. And Berezovsky basically took political asylum here, even though he's implicated in the bombings that also implicate Putin. Now, what the Scotland Yard are suggesting is that they want to interview people in Russia connected to Putin about this poisoning of Litvinenko. Now, the other possibility is that Berezovsky was a pretty ruthless guy, poisoned his own associate, Litvinenko, with polonium, leaving a trail back to Putin. Now, I'm not saying that's true. I'm not saying it's not true. But this is the kind of world these people operate in. Top businessmen and journalists are killed every week in Russia. That's how business is done. It just happened to be happening on the streets of London.
Well, let's leave it to the inquest to find out, but that's an interesting insight into the possibilities of that. The other one, of course, is the one you mentioned briefly earlier on. That is the US playing the Saudi envoy game. That is to say, a possibility of an Iranian plot within the United States to kill the Saudi ambassador to the US. So let's have a little listen now, back to Tuesday this week, to the news story announcing that.
Two men have been charged in America over an alleged plot to murder the Saudi Arabian ambassador to the United States. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Holder claims it was directed by the Iranian government and involved bombing the Saudi and Israeli embassies.
And constitutes a flagrant violation of U.S. and international law. In addition to holding these individual conspirators accountable for their alleged role in this plot, the United States is committed to holding Iran accountable for its actions.
Well, Jeff Holder there. It sounds like a very serious plot, Martin. But, I mean, nowadays, why? Well, I mean, it is a serious allegation to make against the Iranians.
But it's not credible in any way.
Why is it not credible?
Well, the Iranians don't work through Mexican drug cartels, for a start. There's no evidence that they've ever worked with them. You know who does work with Mexican drug cartels? Eric Holder. He was the guy who was responsible for selling them all of these weapons which have gone AWOL.
But, I mean, that's surely what you're suggesting.
Presumably being used to kill a load of people in Mexico.
Surely what you're suggesting is that he has been up to no good and he's now blaming somebody else.
Yeah,
they're trying.
There's a number of motives for what the secret state in America is doing here. One is to kind of muddy the waters. You've got Occupy Wall Street. You've got various things going on, that like they're being caught out because they've sold all these weapons to the Mexican drug cartels. And, you know, having a distraction would be useful. But don't forget, there's been a long-run plan by the secret state in America to have a war with Iran. And all the Republican candidates for president have all weighed in saying we should attack Iran now. They're frothing at the mouth. You know, they've got proof, as far as they're concerned, that the Iranians are carrying out terrorism on their soil. Although, in actual fact, as we said earlier, the Stuxnet, Tom Pavlenty, their former governor, said that the US created the Stuxnet virus and that the US was also involved in the assassination of of Iranian nuclear scientists. Now, the Iranians have been saying this for ages, that the Israelis and the Americans and MI6 have been involved in killing various people inside Iran, terrorist actions, bombs in mosques, assassinations of senior officials and of nuclear scientists. Now, so the Iranians are basically suffering a terrorist wave inside Iran, orchestrated by our intelligence services.
But isn't this the
but
only...
they're being blamed for doing something in the US. And... Well,
isn't this the only way to stop nuclear proliferation?
No, well, the Iranians could take the view that that's what they should do. Also, of course, the assassination of the Saudi ambassador. We tried to kill Gaddafi. Now, the Saudi regime is far more repressive, and they don't have any elections at all. They've got to go, surely, in the Arab Spring. And therefore, the Saudi ambassador to the US, under our own rules, is a legit target. Gaddafi's children are legit targets, for goodness sake. So the Saudi ambassador, from a completely repressive state that has no checks and balances, no elections, he's a target, surely. And surely that's the lesson of the Libyan revolution. Never mind protesting in the streets, you've got to get the guns, you've got to get the Semtex, you've got to start hitting them hard. And that Saudi ambassador absolutely fits that, doesn't he? Now, the Iranians have not been doing this because they're quite smart. They don't want to give the Americans any excuse. They're having enough on their hands to control the terrorism inside their own borders, which is being orchestrated from the outside, from Israel, from Britain, and from the US. But we're going to war with Iran. The banks are going to collapse, and we're going to war with Iran. And when that happens, the ordinary people will suddenly wake up and realise what's happened. They've been sold down the river completely, financially and in terms of war.
Also, Egypt, things aren't looking too rosy after what seemed like quite a nice revolution earlier on this year, and getting rid of Hosni Mubarak. There's been clashes, killed 25 people. The Coptic Christians did a demonstration. The army just simply firing into the crowd.
And driving trucks into the crowd.
And actually,
as well.
Yes, driving lorries straight into the crowd. I mean, this doesn't look good, does it, for the elections coming up?
No, it doesn't. And what's going on there is like the elections in South Africa in the 90s. in the run-up to the election, violence increases. Lots of activists are still being arrested in Egypt, taken away and tortured. We're not hearing anything about that. I mean, surely, I mean, don't forget that the mosque in the cathedral in Alexandria was bombed on Christmas Day, and it turned out that was the security forces inside Egypt trying to create tension.
Yes,
between
the interior minister actually behind it. Yeah.
So what they're trying to do is create as much chaos as possible. And surely the lesson of Libya is quite clear. The Egyptians should pick up guns and start killing the army, and then the RAF will come in and bomb the tanks for them, won't they? I mean, that's the message, isn't it? All of this peaceful revolution stuff is all over now. It's violent revolution time. There's 30,000 people possibly being killed in Libya, but that doesn't matter because we've won. The free people have won. And of course, the lesson in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia, in all the pro-Western regimes is exactly the same. It's time to start the killing, isn't it? It's a nonsense, and we're going down that road. Exactly where we're going.
Well, it seems like there's sectarian violence is erupting.
It's being
encouraged
by the government in order to prevent a change of power.
Okay, but what about, finally, what about Syria? Because the European Union has been hailing this new Syrian opposition group, and they seem to be getting their act together in Syria, even though the United Nations has prevented NATO intervention.
Well, I wouldn't like to second guess what's going on in Syria or Libya or any of these countries. It's easy to sit in a radio studio in Bristol and say, oh, I know what's going on in Syria. I don't know, but we're being told a lot of lies by everybody. Like, for example, it came out that Amnesty International had created a report about this woman who'd been beheaded, and then she popped and said, no, I wasn't beheaded, I'm all right. I mean, I basically just was hiding somewhere. Now, we were talking earlier about the internet. Events can be created on the internet. Impressions can be created on the internet. There are clearly armed clashes going on in Syria, just like in Libya. So there are two sides to it. It's not peaceful demonstrators necessarily being shot down by the government. The so-called peaceful demonstrators have also got people in there who are shooting back and are creating conflict. What's going to happen, I fear, is that the whole Middle East is about to be plunged into chaos. Israel's going to attack Lebanon and Iran, and we're going to have a general war which Britain will be dragged into. And it's going to happen quickly. All of this stuff will happen far more quickly than people realise. It's not going to be like the Iraq war, where we had a long, slow build-up. We will wake up one morning to find that we are in a major war. And at that point, as the banks collapse, and at that point, the scales will fall from people's eyes. It's going to be far too late. People will wake up, but it's going to be far too late.
But certainly people are waking up, as you might say, in the US with these big protests at Wall Street and other parts of the country. But there is this suggestion that tomorrow that there will be an OccupyLondon.org.uk is the website, that there will be an occupation of the Stock Exchange in London. What are your thoughts about that? What do you think?
Well, I mean, the time is now. The people are us. Who else?
There's also a suggestion to occupy Bristol Saturday, October the 15th at 12 p.m. on College Green. But do you think this is just a kind of copycat thing? From
well,
what
of course,
have
it's a copycat thing. That's how it works. How do you think revolutions worked in 1848 or 1917? What happens is you notice, see what other people are doing. You say, "Hey, we want some of that." But that's how revolutions work.
But in my experience, a lot of these revolutions are kind of hijacked halfway along. A lot of people go into them with good intent, but it ends up being hijacked.
Well, that's always the way, but we haven't really got a choice because we've been backed into a corner. Revolutions are to be absolutely the last resort, but we're at the last resort now. The criminality and violence at the top, all over the world, has reached a point where the ordinary people are basically in a meat grinder, and they've just got to fight back because they haven't got an option. And that goes in all of the countries that we've been talking about. I mean, basically, we are on the edge of probably World War III. That's how it will come to be seen in the history books if we get to write them.
Well, so some calm people are calmly discussing all this stuff, particularly the financial crisis. The Bromsgrove Group is meeting this weekend in Birmingham, which has been running for decades now, which is a monetary reform discussion group. And also the group Positive Money are running a conference in London on the 29th of October called It's Our Money. And there are apparently still plenty of spaces available for that. So what do you think about this other aspect? People don't necessarily have to go out and actually occupy physical space like the Stock Exchange. They can simply discuss and come up with programs for reforming the money system.
Well, you've got to do both. You've got coming up with ideas which you don't actually, put any political force behind them. It's just a talking shop. And of course, occupying things for the hell of it without any kind of program or idea of where you're going is pointless. But I think what's happening is that the reality is forcing people to confront the situation, and the demands are quite clear. Stop the wars, make the rich pay their taxes and stop the cuts on the poorest and most vulnerable.
Make the FTSE, the quarter of the FTSE 100 pay their taxes and get their
exactly.
money out.
I mean, if we can't get the money back from them, yes, we can. You've just got to show sufficient will. If you want that money and you need that money, you've got to get it off them. They've stolen it. We ought to get it back. I mean, they're doing deals with Swiss people who've not, with the Swiss, so that people bring their money back. They should have been paying tax in Britain. They'll be let off prosecution and they'll be given a special tax rate if they bring their money back. I mean, this is basically negotiating with criminals about crime. You shouldn't do that. You should bust them and then take all their money off them. Because once somebody is convicted as a criminal and their criminal assets can be confiscated. So then you don't. And what you do is you threaten to confiscate all of it and prosecute them unless they start paying up. And of course, we're wrong.
Bristol Community FM, 93.2.
Okay, Martin, sorry interrupting you with a jingle there, but it's come time now to talk about our roads. They're filled with potholes, and is our driving getting worse? Well, Martin and I are also joined by Sherry Townsend as well, who, you've been borrowing cars, Sherry, I know, over the last while, and you haven't actually got one at the moment. But what are your thoughts on the state of driving nowadays? I mean, all of us here have been driving for a good few years. One of the reasons that I love living in Bristol and not in London is because people down around here generally drive better than they do in London. What are your thoughts, Sherry, about the state of driving today and whether people are any good at it or not?
Well, personally, I've been borrowing a car, which is a really nice new car compared to my old car. And what I've noticed through driving around Bristol is that if you're driving a new car, people don't let you pull in. And if you're about to pull in somewhere, they speed up. I personally don't like driving and I'm sticking with the bus at the moment just simply because I feel extremely violent whilst driving a car because it is, and you can. It's just really aggressive. It's like before you get in a car, you have to get your armour on. You have to build yourself up. It's really scary. People don't let you pull out, and they do cut you up, and they get really nasty with you if you're just in their way.
So, isn't the answer just sort of to be very, very calm, to give yourself like twice the amount of time to get from A to B, Martin?
Well, you're one to say, Tony, is all I can say on that one. We've got to drive later, so we can perhaps. Discuss it as we're driving along. I do think that driving has driving is a bit of a struggle and a strain, but frankly if you go to other countries you'll see that their driving is actually, dare I say it, worse than ours. I was done for speeding recently. I was 7 miles over the speed limit and I had to go to one of these speed awareness workshops, which I had to pay for it. It was a pain, but it meant that I didn't have to take any points on my licence and so on. And in actual fact, it was 4 hours long, so it's made into a bit of a detention for people. But at the same time, people talked about their driving, and it's a good thing to talk about. Basically, people like talking about driving, and one of the things, when it works, I quite like about British drivers is they are quite conscious of other road users. I mean, I had an Iranian taxi driver when I was in London the other day, and he was saying, well, look, if you think this is bad, you should go to Tehran, and you will see some really shocking driving. And of course, if you look at, we've all seen pictures of Bombay and even Rome. People just drive like crazy, hands at the foot to the floor with their hand on the horn.
Because in the modern,
that at least doesn't happen here.
In the modern high-speed world, it's really the main way we're actually interacting with other people in the city, isn't it? Through the way we're driving. We're driving next to them, behind them, in front of them, letting them pull out, not letting them pull out. Sherry, what's your experience of which kinds of cars, which makes of cars do you think are driven by the worst drivers and which by the best? Any ideas? Or is it just the old bangers are driven by...
I don't know. I would say the bigger the car, the bigger the man thinks his manhood is. to say,
Martin's got a tiny car.
Indeed.
But no, it does. That they seem to think that you're not going to get in the way. And of course, after driving my little old antique car, I just used to get around normally. But then driving a completely different car, it's amazing. I would personally say the choice of car you make is to do with the choice of your driving.
And what about the fact that it's a brand new car, it's a very powerful machine, a big machine. Does that make you drive worse, do you think?
No, if anything, I'm more cautious, especially with everyone else on the road. It's scary. I personally would rather drive an old car than a new one, because people do cut you up. If they have their indicator on, it obviously gives them the right to pull in front of you. Oh, look, you're a female, so again, I have the right to pull in front of you. Really, really scary. I don't like the roads at all in Bristol.
Martin, what about you? Any favourite makes of car other people drive? Well, I'm going to tell you what mine are in a minute.
There is the notorious white van man, as we all know, who appears in our lives with depressing frequency.
They always seem to be driven by very young drivers who clearly aren't the people who are paying for the insurance.
The people who are really poor drivers are young men. That's quite clear from the statistics. I mean, I remember driving once when I was driving just down the road, and I could see this car hanging, waiting to pull out. And I was driving within the speed limit at 30 miles an hour, so there wasn't really time for them to come out. So they were waiting for me to come out, and then just before I reached them, they got impatient and pulled out in front of me. How old were they? About 22. And that's why young lads have to pay much higher insurance, because they insist on driving in a silly way. And I actually lost many of my friends from school to car accidents in the first few years after they were drivers, because they drove like crazy people. And we've still got that tradition in this country. You see them burning up the road, don't you? They're in a 30-mile-an-hour zone and they're driving as if they're in a Grand Prix. Hopeless.
But I would say the boy racer people are more apt to keep their car looking nice rather than...
Not like bothered with hitting. So
they'll drive, you know, the boy racer type, you know, the ones that are labelled, they're the ones with the nice cars that spend a lot of time polishing them and getting them
so they drive up very close to you, but they won't actually hit you.
Well, no. Yeah. I mean, the statistics show that they are the most dangerous drivers, which is why they have to pay more in insurance. But actually, road safety statistics are improving in this country.
And what about motorway driving? Because this is one of my bugbears. You get a lot of people nowadays, and if you go back 20 years, and this was nowhere near the case, that they just cruise along in that middle lane the whole time.
Oh, that's so annoying. Or on the last lane as well, and you're not supposed to overtake them.
In the fast lane, yeah. Yeah, the middle lane cruisers, I think they're one of the big bugbears of the last 20 years.
And
when they've overtaken a lorry, rather than actually pull back into the slow lane, they just sit there in the middle lane for the next 10 miles.
Well, I mean, in this speed workshop, we had to look at various scenarios and what we would do, you know, like videos that we were watching. And I think that one of the problems is that some people don't drive fast enough and some people drive too fast. You should always drive within the speed limit. Having been busted, I've learnt my lesson. But people often drive less than the speed limit, and that creates frustration in those behind them. They try and overtake, and then you get an accident.
Just one statistic I dug out for this. You've got about 500,000 miles to go in between every accident. On average, every vehicle gets an accident every 500,000 miles. And we've got something like 300,000 cars and 12,000 lorries have an accident every year. Anyway, that was our little discussion on driving. That's all the serious talk out of the way, because after the Sky News at 7, Friday night is Music Night, 2 hours live with Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party. We're at thisweek.org.uk for the podcast.